This is Rich's Random Podcast Generator number 21, recorded January 26, 2013. Interview with John Horton, University of Southern Maine electrical engineering student turned theater major.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jim.
I'm Rich.
And welcome to show number 21, recorded on January 26, 2013. Here on Rich's Random Podcast Generator, we cover just about anything we want, from group hangout conversations to tech product reviews to interesting interviews, all tech, all the time, all posted out at theaverageguy.tv. You can contact Rich or me via email. Just send it to us, podcast@theaverageguy.tv, or follow the schedule on Twitter, @theaverageguy.tv. We also have all the links to automatically download or stream the audio or video podcast, if we have that part, to iTunes, YouTube, Zoom, Stitcher, or many of the other podcatcher applications available right there on the front page of theaverageguy.tv. Of course, you can always find us on YouTube, iTunes, Google+, even Facebook. We've got a really good group on Facebook going, by the way, out there. If you have not joined us, you can do that just by searching The Average Guy Podcast, and please leave some comments, likes, votes, plus ones, or all those other helpful tidbits to make sure we know you are there. And that Facebook group is facebook.com/groups/theaverageguy. About 115 guys out there with some really great conversation going on. So if you haven't joined the Facebook group, join it. Well, we welcome you back to Rich's Random Podcast. Rich and I have been off. Rich has been busy doing some schooling, and we just haven't got back around to it. But 21 is here, and we're glad that we are back. Rich, good to see you, and good to have a podcast rolling again.
Yeah. You know, I'm not the multitasker that you are. We were just telling John at the beginning of the show all the things you do. I'm have a hard time walking and chewing gum. Mm-hmm. So, but I'm learning, you know. So.
Yeah, well, it's good to have the podcast back.
It's Rich, really good.
We have a special guest, and so why don't you take a second and introduce who we have?
We do. So I work at the University of Southern Maine, and one of the places I work is the theater building, Russell Theater in Gorham, Maine. And one of the students I met is our guest today, John Horton. And we'll talk with John a little bit, and we'll talk about his upbringing. His dad was an engineer for DEC and Intel, and John was he's a smart guy who had a father that was doing a really technical, very interesting technical job, and John was influenced by that, and off and running, doing projects, all kinds of things, when he was just, you know, a youngster. And you know, when I first met John, we started talking about things, and I thought, well, you know, I'll tell him this, and he'll say, oh yeah, no, John would take whatever I said, and he'd run off with it. So I says, at some point, and I approached him, I says, at some point, John, we're going to have to talk on air live. So with that in mind, let me introduce John Horton. John, thanks for joining us today.
It's good to be here.
Yeah. Okay, John. So you are a theater major now at USM, University of Southern Maine, but you first started off as an electrical engineer.
I did.
Yeah. So why is a guy, and we'll talk about your background, your upbringing, and your dad's stuff, but influence, but why did you decide to drop electrical engineering and jump into the theater? Do you want to be an actor? What's going on?
Sometimes I wonder that myself. I have no real interest in acting or any of those more artsy things. Now I work as a technician, both in the theater here and other places back down in Massachusetts. But coming to school for electrical engineering, at first I thought, oh yeah, I can, you know, learn the tricks of the trade and apply them in a field I enjoy. But it turns out the field I enjoy, while electrical engineering is a very large part of it, I wasn't having the same opportunities in school for engineering that I could if I was a theater student.
Now explain what that means. I don't think I've quite followed that. Is there something about working in the theater that gives you more hands-on with things? Or what is that?
Absolutely. In electrical engineering courses I was taking, it was very math-based. And it's not that I'm averse to math, but everything was theoretical or done hypothetically rather than being able to build things and work with my hands, which is very important to me.
Right. I've seen you, John also works in the scene shop, and I've seen him build a park bench the other day out of some square steel tubing and some 2x4s, and it looks just like a regular park bench with bent legs and everything. John, so look, I do want to talk about your home, your beginnings. Your dad, tell us about your dad, because I know your dad had a big influence on you. I mean, not a lot of people have a dad who's an electrical engineer he was a chemical engineer, actually. But yeah, go ahead. Take it away.
He originally was a chemical engineer. He went to MIT in 1968 for chemical engineering, just right about the time of the oil crisis. So chemical engineers were in high demand. But after a few different jobs, he fell into working in first the electro-optics industry, building photon multipliers for night vision goggles, and then went further into the fabrication of semiconductors and later the design. Before I was born, he worked up here in Maine at Fairchild Corporation before moving down to Mass, where I'm from originally, and started working at DEC in the late 1980s. And late 1980s, early 1990s, when I was a little kid, he was a designer, and I distinctly remember having him bring me into work and show me the CAD programs, what I now know to be CAD, that he was using to design chips and all those sorts of things using a hardware abstraction language.
And how old were you when he first started bringing you into shop?
I think there's a photograph of me when I was about 4 years old in a child-sized bunny suit going into the fab.
That's awesome, man. Oh, that's awesome. Wonderful. Yeah. So what did you think of that? I mean, was it something about walking into that environment that you said, wow, I would love to do what Dad is doing or something like that?
Yeah, I just thought it was really cool. I remember him bringing home bits of process equipment and extra circuits and all sorts of random bits and bobs. And I started, instead of playing with Lincoln Logs, I started wiring together random bits of extra equipment. And, of course, none of it was functional, but it got me familiar with just having my hands on technology. And as I grew up with him around, we were able to have many projects together of that sort. And bought me the whole set of the 4-stem MIMS electric circuit books that Radio Shack used to sell back then, and bought me breadboard and a whole bucket of components, and I started building circuits like that with him.
Did you subscribe to, what's that magazine? Like Popular Electronics, maybe, is what it was called.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely the 4-stem MIMS Radio Shack little booklets, the cheaply printed ones with diagrams and explanations I read as a kid.
Yeah, okay, I'm not familiar with those, but it sounds like they were something that Radio Shack put out and were... so you were building those circuits at the age of what?
Around about the age of 8.
Okay, so now tell me something. Tell me, what was your first thing that you built that you go, wow, this is really great?
I remember one of my first projects with my dad of that sort was building a binary flip-flop where you have a momentary push switch, and with a set of 4 transistors, it toggles one LED on and the other one off and preserves that state. So basically one bit of computer memory.
Yeah. Oh, for people that don't know, John is sitting in the theater lounge at school. He's sitting in the lounge just outside the scene shop, and it's Saturday, there are people in there working. So if you hear voices in the background, that's his that's his crew.
It makes for good live radio.
Yeah. I'm glad for a directional mic, because right now someone is running plywood through the table saw, and it's rather loud.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I can't hear it.
That's pretty good for that mic, for that little mic, if we're not hearing it at all.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
Quite a day's worth of work ahead of us. My first project is that binary flip-flop, and from then on, we build all sorts of other very simple circuits, 555 timer oscillators, things like that, but more or less the foundation of all modern electronics.
Okay. I'm going to be honest with you here. Some of these things I've heard of, I couldn't tell you what they were, but... And I know if I was to press you for it, you'd sit there and explain them to me, but we're not going to do that. This is not going to be an educational day for Rich here. Some other day. geez, let me think here. One thing that kind of impressed me, we were talking about networking one day, and you told me that your dad brought you into a storage room where there was a bunch of old computers sitting around, maybe some old servers and whatnot, and network cards and maybe hubs and switches. And he says, you know, this is basically up for grabs. And you did what with that?
Well, that was actually what really turned me on to computers. I was in 2005, so it's not quite yet a teenager. No, I was a teenager. Sorry, the years are blending together. I stand corrected, it was 2003. And my dad was working as a part-time faculty at a local college, Worcester Polytechnic Institute. And they had a huge storeroom full of old computers, Pentium 2s and 3s, Macs, things like that, that they were getting rid of. So I had free rein to pretty much dumpster dive. And I went home with 3 carloads worth of hardware. And from that, he and I built on our front porch basically a learning lab for computers. Had a number of machines running Windows 95 and Windows 2000, a couple of Macs and a couple of Unix boxes, and had a big network switch that was able to just plug together and try, oh, I think I'll install a server here and all that. And that's what brought me into studying network topology and all those sorts of things.
John, you were about 11 years old when you were doing that, 11 or 12 years old, right? You're 21 now. You just turned 21, just past Christmas, right?
I am. Right. And after years of calculus, I can't do basic subtraction.
No, it ruins you, right? That high-level okay. math ruins okay. your basic stuff. I'd probably say that was 96, 97, 98, right? Those, if we can put all those pieces together, as you were talking about Pentium 3s and some of those other... you know, I learned, John, very similar in those same years, actually. So I was a little late to the game. I had spent some time in the military, and then I'd done retail banking for a lot of years. And in that same, in those same years, I worked for a PC company that I did some repair for them. And we bought and sold used computers, and a lot of times we'd buy used computers, and they were just junk. And so we would, I'd say, can I have this? And so I'd take it home, and... You know, Rich, you talk about how busy I am. I would spend from, you know, when I got home from work or dinner, you know, once dinner was over, I had a young family at the time, we'd put the kids to bed, and I would stay up till 2 or 3 in the morning putting these things together, trying to make them work. I mean, I can imagine you as an 11 or 12-year-old trying to make Windows 95 work because it was, oof, you know, drivers and a mess, and you had to do
IRQs.
Yeah.
The whole darn thing, you know.
You know, it's crazy to think of that. But I learned in that same era, kind of with you, and never looked back. So it was a good, I mean, let me just say, I applaud your father for immersing you, giving you the opportunity to immerse you in some of that technology, because that stuff's really super important. Did you find yourself, I mean, how many, were you doing it instead of doing your homework? Were you, you know, that kind of stuff? How did you approach it?
Well, at some points I did it instead of, you know, enjoying sunlight, but I found a certain balance. Around that time I had stopped playing the sports I'd previously played. So I had a lot of free time, and you know, going to public school in Worcester didn't eat up too long. I didn't have a lot of homework, those sorts of things. So I basically had hours of free rein every day that often enough I chose to sit in the basement with you know, single light and wire up networks instead of joining all the other kids.
Yeah, and what was the first network, as you put that together? Was that the early stages of Ethernet, or were you doing, I'm trying to remember what the other one was, Token Ring?
Yeah, Token Ring. It was actually a mix. It ranged between probably 99 and 2003, and I started off with doing Token Ring, serial Token Ring with the Macintoshes, the old adapters that went from their network port to... standard telephone line, and also 10Base2, the coaxial thin net, which was pretty popular. And in the subsequent couple of years, Twisted Pair, 10Base-T, and 100Base-T really took over. And especially when 100Base-T came out, there were tons of 10Base-T cards up for grabs that I got from university and all those sorts of things, and was able to start building with that.
And these are networks where they have little T terminator, a T connection, and you have to terminate one of the ends with a 50 ohm resistor. And if you don't, nothing works. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes. It's, you know,
I remember this from when my brother
wasn't that long ago.
No, it
wasn't. It's crazy.
I remember my brother, who's a programmer, who first got me into computers, he's a point-of-sales developer, and he'd network computers throughout customer stores, and that's what they were using. They were using this coaxial, and, you know, and if something didn't work, you know, well, geez, that resistor on the end of that, you know, I mean, the configurations to make these things work. I'm glad the Ethernet is here. Just get one kind of cord, plug it in one end, plug the same end, looking end into another jack, and you're good to go.
Yeah. But,
so, John, as you moved into your high school years then, right? I mean, that's kind of elementary school, junior high. You kind of grew up in a really exciting technology time.
You know, I did.
Lots of changes. I mean, we from Windows 95 to... You know, you think to Windows XP, the landscape completely changed for both Windows, Linux, and Mac software. Where did you land as you got into high school? Kind of where did you land? What kind of spaces did you land in? Did you stay involved in tech in high school?
I did. I started, you know, late junior high and high school, just about the time where I was transitioning from the kind of classical desktop-style computing where you had had to deal with drivers, IRQs, and all that, to the more plug-and-play modern world. You know, Facebook came around when I was in high school and all that sort of thing, and all of a sudden everyone had computers, but still not too many people understood the underlying topology. And in high school, is when I started getting involved in the technical side of theater as well. And the changes going on in the computer world quite affected the technical side of things, because we went from analog control voltage style, say, lighting controls and analog mixing boards for sound, to a new digital system. Nowadays, a lot of things for lighting are run through Ethernet-like connections, or even Wi-Fi for the board at the university here. So also at that time, my high school was swapping out their old half token ring, half 10... The faster quacks, I think it was 10 base 5 or whatever, for modern Ethernet, which I gave me a lot of extra hardware to play around with as getting thrown out, for one, and allowed me to surreptitiously play around in my school's network with things like, well, what was then called Ethereal, now is Wireshark and Nmap and things like that. And I took basically exploring my high school's network and all that sort of thing home with me, and started to play around my own home networks. Also around this time, the exploitation sort of battle between the white hats and black hats in the computer industry changed from just viruses and all those sorts of things to what we have nowadays, with far more subtle attack venues. Because, you know, Metasploit came out, and all of a sudden the world had a far more powerful weapon to do penetration testing.
John, Metasploit, you picked that up. That's a hacker's tool. Security professionals use it for pen testing, penetration testing. Some company might say, hey, you know, security expert, come over here and try to hack into my network. Tell me where we're strong, where we are weak, and Metasploit is one of the tools they use. You picked it up and started using it, am I right?
I did. Not maliciously, but I had set up boxes in my house, you know, running, say, Windows 2000 at the time, running with an Apache server or an FTP server, and I'd try seeing where the weak points were, and unfortunately, there are lots of weak points.
Mm-hmm. So, like, give me an example of, don't go into big detail, but give me an example of the kinds of exploits that Metasploit is set up to probe.
Well, it's based off of the Ruby programming language, and exploits of any sort can be loaded in from pre-made code or written yourself. It focuses a lot on stack buffer overflows in service in programs that monitor a port on a computer, say a network server, FTP, or web server, things like that. And also deals with a few other things. It can do some password cracking, although there are better tools for that, and other things, attacking various layers and network stacks of computers. I haven't used it recently, so it might have changed, but yeah, at the time it was a very point-and-click sort of thing.
I know it's something that they're constantly evolving and updating. Probably 2 weeks ago, we saw Java was in the news again, a big zero-day Java exploit. And as I'm searching around, I see Metasploit had updated their module to include that exploit for part of their testing. You, John, you mentioned Wireshark. And we got into a discussion about that a little bit. And I told you that I had played around with it a little bit. But as often happens with me, I didn't have any real need to, you know, use that, or I couldn't find it. But I understand that you, I understand that people can use that to see network traffic. And we were sitting there last week and looking at some traffic. Most of it was garbage, but some of it was. Why don't you take it from there? Why don't you tell us about Wireshark a little bit?
Wireshark is a very powerful network analysis tool, especially for network administrators who can configure certain things in the network to make it more accessible. It is not an intrusion detection system, nor is it truly a hacker tool, to use words like that. But it can take two flavors of capture. It can simply follow what's going on between your computer and the rest of the world, in which case you can find what services on your computer are dialing home, how well your data is being encrypted and all that. Mm-hmm. Or, depending on your network configuration, you can watch the entire network.
What do you mean you can watch the entire network?
Well, watching the entire network, specifically for wired...
Yeah. How would you do that?
It requires one of two things. Either requires a network switch router that features port mirroring, which most Cisco ones and 3Com switches have. I'm not sure about other brands. Cisco has something called SPAN, which is the switched port analyzer, and 3Com has RAP, which is roving analysis port. But they basically mean the same thing. You can take one or all of the network ports on a switch or router and mirror them to a single port, in which case Wireshark can suck that up en masse. Or you can also do a network tap, much like the old-style vampire taps for ThinNet. Nowadays, they're basically a T-connector for Ethernet, and that's a little bit more crude, but does the same sort of thing.
Vampire tap. What's that?
A physical tap in a network line that interrupts the line and splits off into a third line, which you can then send to, say, an intrusion detection system, or in this case, Wireshark.
Okay. I know that there is a another package that goes hand-in-hand with Wireshark that also lets you get out and sniff network traffic, and that is something called PCAP, and if you're on Windows, it's called WinPCAP. Now, what I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, but there's something about your Ethernet card. It maybe WinPCAP, is it a driver that allows this thing called promiscuous mode to happen so that it can listen to traffic other than its own?
This is true. The PCAP library, libpcap on Unix and Linux, and WinPCAP, I'm not certain how it functions on Macintosh computers, is a engine for monitoring network traffic. Normally, if your computer sees messages destined for other MAC addresses, it simply ignores them. But this more or less opens the floodgates and allows you to read everything. And practical terms, it's simply a engine you need to have installed on your computer, whether it be Windows, Mac, possibly, or Linux, in order to have Wireshark see as much as it can see.
Do we need a special network card to go along with this WinPCAP?
Wired network, it can be any sort of network card you want, as far as I know.
Yeah.
And then for wireless network, I haven't done as much work in that recently, but it's typically the Atheros chipset is the most forgiving for things like network sniffing and a few other things, such as packet capture in order to crack the encryption WP or WPA on wireless networks. I'm not quite certain how the differences in wireless interface matter. I'm not too versed on that.
Right. Yeah. That's fine. We were looking at air traffic. We were looking at wireless traffic, and it's interesting. I can't say that we saw anything of really major interest, but I think it's interesting that you can. Somebody can just sit there, and you were just doing this with software. There was nothing special about it. You have a Mac, and you downloaded Wireshark, and apparently either Macs allow promiscuous mode right out of the chute, or the Wireshark package for Macs also includes air PCAP and probably PCAP for wired. So we were sitting there, and we were looking at different, traffic from different computers on the network. Now, of all the things that we saw, what do we see that was probably the most, should we say, interesting?
I find...
Because what I'm trying to get at is that while you can sit there, it sounds like, gee whiz, I got to watch out for everything I do. What can people really see with this? I mean, we know that if you encode your traffic just by asking for HTTPS, and there's an add-in for, is it Firefox?
It's called, for Firefox and Chrome now.
Yeah, HTTPS everywhere. So you can use that add-in to request encrypted connections. So if you're in a cafe and you're on HTTPS, presumably, somebody can sit there all day long and sniff your traffic, and all they're going to see is garbage. Correct?
Yes, yeah. That is correct. I have HTTPS everywhere. I use Chrome, and it makes me feel very secure. I definitely recommend it. The problem with a lot of internet forums, meaning not chat boards, but the forums you fill in to transmit information, is that most of them are mixed plain text and HTTPS. For example, I can put in a credit card number on a website, and I'm certain that'll be encrypted, because they tend to be. But my billing address or my shipping address, things like that, often enough are unencrypted. I'm not sure which websites do that and which don't. I've never really checked. Identity theft is not simply sniffing a credit card number. It's finding a home address, finding every bit of personal information as possible. And I'd rather not give people anything.
Right, yeah, accumulation of data over time. It's funny, when I first got on the internet, it was back in 95, and Windows 95 came pre-configured to share the C drive. And I grabbed a hold of this old software utility called, I'm going to say it was New World Scanner, although I've never been able to find it since, but I believe that's what it was called, and I just did like a block IP scan of the network around my in my ISP's network, and lo and behold, I could see people's computers. They were saying, yeah, we're open and available, come on in. And one time I just went in just to see, can I do it? Not to be malicious, but I shouldn't have done it, but I did. I went in there and I just looked around. I says, oh my God, I can see everything. I need to get out of here. But, so obviously computers... We're coming from a place where computers way back in the day, they weren't really created, they weren't designed with security in mind. But today, we know that everything, personal information, credit card numbers, all these sorts of things, we want to keep them secure, right? With an HTTPS connection, at least that.
Yes.
Yeah. So along that same line, do we know that most email, like Yahoo email or any of the other that maybe, because Gmail, don't they automatically put you in HTTPS now?
Gmail does. I can't speak for Yahoo because I haven't used it since Bush was president. Thing is, even
seems so long ago.
It does. Mm-hmm. But by default, your Google search form is not encrypted, which isn't the most terrifying thing. But even so, every little bit of information can be dangerous. It's interesting. I had a similar experience to you in 95 browsing someone else's C drive. I was sitting at a cafe with trying out my laptop because I just converted to Mac and it's terrifying. And I did an open network scan of the free unencrypted Wi-Fi there, and the amount of things I could see in plain text, 99% of them completely innocent, but just being able to see them in plain text was rather terrifying. It was to me the same as someone standing over my shoulder reading my screen.
Yeah.
And anyone can do that. And even though I might not have anything to hide, it's still a disturbing feeling.
Yeah. I would hope that at least the major email providers are encrypting their traffic and their Gmail traffic.
John, you had mentioned HTTPS everywhere. So how do you or what do you use? I assume you're using some kind of browser plugin that forces a secure connection to everything, or how do you do that?
It's a browser plugin, much like, say, AdBlock or any of those others that people tend to run, and it works seamlessly with most websites. And the only difference you'll see outwardly is that, say, you go to Google, it'll no longer be just http://google.com. but rather HTTPS, and it forces, where available, it cannot create a false connection, but where available, it forces websites to use HTTPS. Often enough, ones that do have it but not enabled by default have, say, settings, if you have an account with them, but that plugin bridges all of that and forces it to happen, and it's wonderful, and I haven't looked into the nuts and bolts of it too much, but I know what its function is, and it makes me sleep better at night.
Is that available for IE also?
I'm not sure. I believe it's available only for Chrome and Firefox.
Yeah.
I don't use IE anymore, thankfully.
I went ahead and brought up the site. I think this is right. It's EFF.org / HTTPS everywhere. It does look like right now it's available on Firefox and Chrome, although this looks a little old, at least the front page here. I'm assuming they're updating their software maybe a little more often than they're updating their page, the front page.
Yeah, I believe it's either created or hosted by the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And it's the versions update fairly often. I've updated it twice on my desktop computer, which I've had for a year, so...
Do you run into any problems with that in some particular sites where it's not secure? I mean, what's the downside to using something like that?
I've never seen a downside. There most likely is a very slight speed cost because establishing an HTTPS connection is a bit slower than establishing a normal one. But other than that, if a site does not provide HTTPS, it doesn't attempt to make the same connection. So I've never had a problem with it. There might be some odd cases, but...
Okay. So really, no, you can't use it in IE. You'd have to be using Firefox or Chrome. No Safari either, but a lot of us have moved to Chrome browsers. I can install that in a plugin. Do you know, is that available in the App Store or the Chrome Store, I guess is what they're calling it these days?
I would assume so. I can take a look.
Yeah, let's I'll take a peek. You don't have to look right now.
Yeah.
But...
I would assume so. It's it seems to be quite popular, but it is a very safe thing to have, and it's better to have it and not need it than need it and not have it.
Yeah, No, it's not necessarily. I mean, it does create just a smidge of overhead, but for the average person, it would stop a lot of maybe some shenanigans if you're worried. Especially if you travel a lot and you're connecting to a lot of unsecure wireless points at Starbucks or on the, in the airports, or you know, I do oh, a couple times a year I'm out on the road for a couple weeks, and so I do a lot of, I just grab Wi-Fi wherever I can, and maybe a nice little tool to keep at least everything I can get secure is secure that way.
Is it something that you had been using, Jim?
No, no, I do. I do try to be secure from a, you know, like Facebook. I've turned on the HTTPS all the time on Facebook. They've got an option inside of that that, although I don't really transmit anything on Facebook, I really even care about, right? I mean, it's a place for social chatter.
And, well, you know, again, this is true. But you know, the thing that correct me, but I think this is right. The reason why initially people didn't really want to do HTTPS everywhere is because it's a more of a load on the server to actually have to provide encrypted traffic. Now, I don't know if it's still that way or if the servers are just able to deal with it better, maybe better, stronger servers, better processors. I don't know, maybe better algorithm, I'm not sure. But maybe that's why there isn't HTTPS everywhere, and so you need to force it where it is, where it may be available. But John, you are pretty obviously you're pretty security conscious. You are running a Mac now. You just got yourself a MacBook Pro, right?
I did, and it's it's a new experience for me.
Okay, are you running any protection on there, any AV or anything like that? I mean, there's some malware out there for Macs now.
I'm not running any AV on this Mac. I actually haven't run antivirus software in a fair amount of time.
Partially not even on your, not even on your little netbook that you were rocking there for a while.
Not even on my little netbook. For Windows machines, I'd still recommend it, but for things like my netbook that eventually became a Linux box and this Mac, it's quite a hit to system resources for good antivirus, and yeah, I'm not. I feel like viruses aren't as much of a threat as they once were.
Where's the threat then? Where is the threat then?
Identity theft and network monitoring, I'd say. Okay. That being said, you know, downloading songs off of Casas still not recommended without antivirus, but. One thing I'm really concerned about is I do all my banking online because I get a penalty for paper banking nowadays.
Right.
And I travel. I travel a lot for work. Most of my Wi-Fi networks on my list here are train station networks and airports and you know Starbucks and various towns. So a lot of my communication to my bank, transferring funds to take something out of the ATM and all, is all going through an unencrypted connection as far as wireless goes. So instead of just doing HTTPS everywhere, I've also done something else. I have you know an internet connection back at the apartment, and I have a moderately powerful desktop running all the time. And I have constructed a VPN between my laptop here and my desktop at home. And I can use that for secure traffic for an internet connection.
What are you using? Are you using something like TeamViewer, or are you using some kind of... what are you using?
Right now I'm using a client called Hamachi, which provides very good encryption, and there's a free version for personal use.
Yeah.
And the important part here
is... Well, does that log me in? John, is that Hamachi log me in, or is it just Hamachi?
That is... it's Log Me and Hamachi, yes.
Okay.
Right. And it's cross-platform, which is good for me because you know I have Linux back home and I have a Mac here, so
it's not no problem.
No problem.
Interesting. Yeah.
And it facilitates many different kinds of encryption, and I would definitely recommend, if not that program, something of that sort for people who tend to travel a lot, because I wouldn't use it for say. Checking Facebook because it is a slow connection. It's limited by the upload speed of my internet connection back home. But for things like my banking and my email for work, I feel a lot safer using it.
Right, yeah. man, it's something that we have to spend all this time configuring. And this is not something the average person would do, you know?
No, although nowadays it is a lot easier than it was even 5 years ago. For example, the LogMe in Hamachi has a wizard sort of interface and is very point and click and easy to set up. And a person could break that up in a matter of minutes.
Yeah. I know a number of our friends have talked about it before. You know, what does the average person do? What do you think the average person should be doing to protect themselves besides not installing LimeWire and downloading every song they can get for free?
For an average person running, say, a Windows computer or a Mac computer, I'd recommend switching away from IE or Safari, you know, the built-in browsers, and going to Chrome or Firefox. I'd recommend installing both the HTTPS Everywhere plugin, which, you know, as we talked about, facilitates secure connections where available, and also installing the AdBlock plugin. Not so much because I, you know, dislike ads, but also because it forces the browser not to load data from other websites that you're not going to.
Yeah. What do you think of NoScript? Yeah, I agree with that. I actually am running the ad block. And when I turn it off, I am just surprised, like, wow, this is what the web really looks like. You know? Yeah. Pages load much more slowly. There's all kinds of crap on a page. I don't care about some party going on down the street, you know. Yeah. What do you think of NoScript? Now, I'll tell you before you answer, I first heard of NoScript on a security podcast called Security Now, Steve Gibson, and I'm pretty sure you've heard of Steve Gibson before. Mm-hmm. It, to me, is that I ran for years with basically no antivirus. All I did was I would use immunization from SpyBot. So I downloaded SpyBot and let it immunize my browser against bad downloads. And then I use something called MVP hosts, and so that is just adding a list of host known bad domains, and just point them to 127.0.0.1, your computer, so that way you never go out and ping those bad domains, so they don't know you're there, so they're not downloading anything to you. And then the other thing I use was JavaScript to protect me against Java and JavaScript exploits. Have you ever used NoScript yourself?
I have used NoScript, and it was definitely a good security move and is a great thing for normal web browsing. The only problem I had with it is my banking website and a couple others I used heavily relied on scripts to work, so every time I'd go to them, I'd have to disable NoScript because otherwise it'd break the site. But otherwise, for normal day-to-day browsing, I would definitely recommend it if you can deal with having to toggle it on and off when it accidentally breaks things. But I suppose...
You can actually whitelist your bank. So I don't know if you knew that. I don't think you knew that. But you could go in there and whitelist your bank.
That makes sense.
I'm pretty sure about that. Anyway, yeah. Yeah. You know, it's a great tool. Probably just doing maybe something like blocking spyware in the first place, not loading LimeWire, using host files, using NoScript. All the other ones are passive. You know, you just have to remember to run the updates to keep your host file updated and maybe run SpyBot updates once in a while. But those are pretty easy to do. But I've tried to push NoScript on some of my friends and family, and they're listening to me like, okay, as soon as he walks away, I'm going to get rid of this thing because it's too much of a pain in the neck. It's too bad the security is like that, but it seems like good security is, it takes some effort, and it's, you know, a lot of people would term that effort as pain in the neck, you know?
It definitely does take effort, and certain consciousness about security as well, you know, knowing when to not do certain things. Like I wouldn't go to my bank's website on an unsecured Wi-Fi in a coffee shop unless I absolutely had to.
Right, and then you'd probably think twice about it.
Yeah.
John, we've talked about a bunch of things that you've done in the past. What are we doing lately here? What are you? Any projects going on? Maybe at your place at home, or what have you got going on? Because every once in a while, I'll hear you come in. You'll be chuckling about something that you did last night. You know, something that maybe didn't quite spark an arc in the kitchen or blew up or whatever. But what are you? What? Talk about some of your fun little home projects.
I have a bunch of them in various states of disrepair around the apartment. One thing that I was going to experiment with is something called packet radio, which is basically internet via radio. It is originated in, I believe, the 1980s around the ham radio scene, and it uses shortwave radio, the 2-meter band, to transmit data. And they have established a entire IP stack for this sort of communication, basically mirroring the internet protocol model, only instead of using internet servers and all those sorts of things, using transmitters and transceivers. And I'm just starting to get into it, but the first purchase is a radio modem, which you can actually build for about $50. And that handles the communication between a hyper terminal sort of client via serial and the acoustic 2-meter transceiver.
What do you expect?
Go ahead, Jim. I was just going to say, what intrigues you about the radio aspect of it? I mean, why that band is not traditionally a heavy carrying band. What intrigues you about that? Why go that route?
It started for me a few years ago. I ran across a ham meetup out near where I worked, and I got to talking with them, and it was reminded me a bit of the early pre-internet sort of bulletin board systems thing, you know, reaching out and getting in touch with people who you otherwise wouldn't be able to contact.
So the community was kind of what got you kind of tied into that?
Yeah, the community and also the sort of DIY ethic that goes along with it. You know, people who built their own transceivers and basically the experimentation of it. You know, the internet is still quite open, but it's not the sort of thing where you can go out there and pick apart websites and pick apart all that and see how it works as easily as you can go in and build your own ham radio and go out there and get in touch with someone in, you know, halfway across the world.
Mm-hmm. So that aspect of it, I mean, that really intrigues you then, that aspect of building it yourself. Because you can do that today on the web, right? I mean, I can reach somebody through this technology anywhere in the world very, very quickly and have conversations. But that aspect of building it yourself, kind of using radio waves instead of the internet, that kind of thing, that's the intriguing part to you?
Yeah, and I also like how it's more or less decentralized. You know, when I send out an email to someone, you know, it bounces through who knows how many servers, I could trace route it, but bounces through who knows how many servers and goes through things that other people built and did, whereas for the most part, with radio, it's, you know, you have something that you most likely built yourself sitting in your house, powered off the wall, and it's sending a message to someone, you know, 200 miles away. And also for me, it's the same reason that, you know, I still have a record player, even though, you know, listening to things in MP3s is so much easier.
John, you're a throwback.
That's awesome.
That is awesome.
Yeah, I think it's a good example of some generational. We're seeing your generation now really take to some more traditional ways of thinking as far as going back to some classic stuff. You talk about listening to records. You talk about using radio waves. You talk about ham radios. I was a CB guy. You know, I did CB radios when I was in high school. It's just very, very interesting because it is a harking back to some things the way they used to be. Of course, we've moved away from that. I don't have a single record here. I do. I'm on the other edge. I'm probably a little bit ahead of most of my peers as far as being everything. I'm all technical all the time. I don't do anything anymore that's old school. So to speak. So you and I have switched positions in life. It should be the other way around, but it's not for whatever reason. Have you gotten involved in the Raspberry Pi project at all? Are you familiar with, when I say Raspberry Pi, have you gotten involved in that?
Yes, the next time I have $35 free, I'm buying one of those things. I have no idea what I'll use it for, but I'm buying it for something.
So Rich and I just need to put $35 together and send you one. I think you would. I think that'd be right up your alley.
Oh yeah, that's probably a good idea, Jim.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
When's your birthday? You don't have to say it. We're live. You don't have to say it.
No, he just had his birthday.
We're I just had my birthday.
Yeah.
I lucked out and was born on New Year's, so.
Oh, very nice. Mm-hmm. Very easy birthday.
Lucky
to remember.
Guy. Yeah, really great. My daughter hates it. She was born on the 28th of December. Well, you know, yeah. You poor holiday babies is what I'm saying.
Especially with the Raspberry Pi, it has the general purpose I/O pins. So, you know, it works. It's a wonderful idea for just having a subcompact computer, you know, the sort of thing you can stick in a car to play MP3s. But it also has a lot of potential as a programmable logic controller, you know, something with the power of a decent computer that you can still interface with sensor modules and all that. And there is a breakout board for it that I read about. I am blanking on the name. It was posted on their blog that has, you know, a breakout for pulse width modulation hookups and analog and digital hookups and all sorts of other wonderful things to experiment with.
Yeah, I think if we put a Raspberry Pi in your hands, it could be a dangerous situation. And I say dangerous lightly. I just think that you'd really enjoy. I've said publicly on all the podcasts that I do that I need a Raspberry Pi like I need a hole in my head, just because it's another thing to do. And I enjoy all that. I enjoy the same kind of getting back to basic stuff and building it from scratch. But for me, that's kind of a hole I could get into and never pull out of. John, we want to wrap this up, but I did want to ask you, what do you have coming ahead there at school? I mean, what kind of things, what kind of projects are you looking for ahead that you're pretty excited about? I mean, obviously there's some cool things going on in the theater department. They're pretty lucky to have a tech guy like you, because theater is theater's all now tech, right? I mean, there's tons of tech in theater. What's coming up that you're most excited about?
Well, for one of our upcoming shows, which is called Orlando, and it's a very by Sarah Rule, and it's a very sort of dreamy piece as a memory play.
Yeah.
We have decided that in lieu of having a traditional set, you know, Luan on a 2x4 frame painted to look like whatever, instead we'll have a set coated with projection paint, which is a sort of off-white gray paint with glass beads inside. That works wonderfully as a projection screen. And for that, we're doing video mapping, which is taking full motion video and distorting it so that it appears to conform to the surface you're projecting it on and appears to be 3D. I liken it most to CGI in movies, only in the real world.
This is going to be quite amazing. I remember when you first started talking about this. If this goes off well, you know, for the future productions, I mean, production costs, the school is teaching people how to use this technology. Wow, what a great opportunity.
What are you using for projectors?
They are, I believe, Philips 10,000 lumen projectors. They're rather pricey, and at this point we have only two. It can be done with any projector, but of course the quality varies.
Mm-hmm.
And we're using, one of the reasons I bought a Macintosh is the software nowadays is all Mac, sadly. And we're using a program called MadMapper, which is, which links into a theater projection video control program called Isadora, via the Quartz Composer interface on Macintosh. And, what we have is we've produced and, acquired video and art and all that to use for the set pieces, and that's being run through Isadora for show control and all, and that is outputted to MadMapper, which maps it to three-dimensional surfaces in real time. And right now we have a static wireframe model of the set for Mad Mapper to conform to, although what I hope to research into soon is a real-time wireframe model, which can be produced by the Xbox Kinect.
Wow.
Which is a wonderful platform mm-hmm. for that sort of thing.
Have you been, so I assume you have a Kinect? Have you been using it?
I do, and it's great. You know, it's a wonderful leap forward in technology, not just for video games, but as a volumetric scanner, it's, you know, it's unmatched, and it's wonderfully cheap, too, which is, you know, for theater, highly important.
Yeah, very cool. So my oldest son bought an Xbox with a Kinect, ended up giving the Kinect piece to my middle son, who's in art school down in Kansas City. Just gave it to him as a Christmas present, just wrapped it up. He has an Xbox, too, and gave it to him. And he's actually trying to interface that with his computer a little bit and do some things. It's too close. You know, the old school one's too, you need to be farther away from it to work. For it to work really well, I'm hoping that Microsoft will continue to make strides on getting that those Kinect sensors. I mean, I'd love to see a Kinect bar that sits like my webcam up there on top of the monitor and gives me kind of full. It's able to kind of map me and the movements of my hands. It would really fix our problem with not having touch screens for larger screens and moving on to touch OSs like Windows 8.
Absolutely.
If it could map me and know fingers and you know what I'm trying to do. So that's very cool, John. You know what? We are just scratching the surface on some of the cool things that you are doing there. if Rich doesn't ask you, I'm going to ask you, would you be open to come back at some point in time and talk to us? I'm really intrigued about what you're doing there in the theater, and I think folks want to know. Rich, this might be a great opportunity to actually shoot some video at some point there on campus and about the mechanics of what you're doing with the mapping and how this you're going to do this whole projection system and how it's laid. I mean, that's some pretty cool stuff that I don't think a lot of people know very much about.
Yeah, I'd be happy to come back and bring more. There's, you know, for this sort of thing, there really is no bottom. You can keep going down any one of these directions and only find more information. So I'd be glad to come back.
Well, it would be good to have you back, John. Thanks for and Rich. Thanks for finding John and befriending him. And a very, very, very interesting. And John, thanks for taking an hour of your time today. I think it's been fantastic to sit here and talk to you as we hear saws in the background. And the mic actually worked out really well. You could just barely hear them, right? Which is kind of cool. Mm-hmm. I mean, usually in podcasting, you want to try and get as much sound out as you can. But the fact that you're right there in the middle of everything that's going on and we can still have this conversation is very cool. So, John, thanks for taking the time today to come out and be with us.
Well, thank you.
Right on. Yep.
I will. I'll remind the folks that are listening that Rich and I actually make this podcast available on Stitcher. And so, if you're looking for a way to automatically, now we're kind of back on track with Rich's random podcast generator. You can get the podcast through Stitcher. If you haven't found a way to automatically download your podcasts, Stitcher is a great way to do it. They're audio only. That's kind of one of the things. But if you're listening to it in your car, you should probably only be listening to the audio anyways. And so go out to Stitcher.com and just search for, I don't know what to search for. I think Rich's Random Podcast Generator would bring that up, or RPG.
That ought to do it, yeah.
And track that down. It'll automatically, you can then stream it right to your phone. We also have all the links to download or stream the audio or video podcast out there through iTunes or YouTube or Zune or, as I mentioned, Stitcher or any other podcatcher application that's available to you. They're all available out on the front page of theaverageguy.tv. Of course, you can find us on YouTube. I mentioned that earlier. We're broadcasting live to YouTube right now. And Rich and I don't have a set schedule on this podcast. We just kind of make it up as we go along when we find interesting interviews to do. And so you might want to follow me on Twitter, just at Jay Collison. Of course, I announce whenever that we are doing upcoming shows. And if you miss them, you can get the back play on YouTube, and we will push this out there as well. Well, for Rich and John, thanks again. This will be another edition of Rich's Random Podcast Generator. And you might want to stay tuned. I think John may be a guy who we have back a couple times to keep us posted on what he's doing. Very cool. Thanks again for coming, John. Thanks for listening to the podcast, and we'll do it all again next time.